Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 25. Hello again, Captain Jeff here, the Airline Pilot Guy, broadcasting live, this time from Dallas-Fort Worth, actually Addison, Texas, a northern suburb of the city of Dallas. And, don't be so surprised. You know, I sometimes put out podcasts in rapid succession. I'm still trying to catch up from all the great feedback that I received for that about a month-long period that I was not podcasting. So we'll try to catch up on some of that today, and hopefully by the end of this episode I'll be all caught up, and I promise I won't go as long as I did last time. Anyway, as I mentioned, here in Dallas-Fort Worth, and earlier today we flew in from Atlanta. We arrived here, somewhere around 10:30, and about that time, this was going on. Breaking news. I was downstairs just a few hours ago, and was watching one of the monitors in the hotel lobby, and was watching CNN, or that's what they had on, and they were talking about this episode of a JetBlue flight. Let me give you a little bit of this coverage from New York's Channel 2.
The pilot after he ran up and down the aisle screaming, and that's not all. The flight was scheduled to arrive in Las Vegas, but had to be diverted to Amarillo, Texas. CBS 2's Chris Raggi here now with the story. Chris.
Maurice, Christine, thank you. We've learned the captain is a veteran pilot. His actions reportedly completely out of character. He's well-respected and well-liked. Now, he's undergoing medical treatment as we speak after passengers say he was running up and down the aisles on the flight, screaming things like, say your prayers, Al-Qaeda, and bomb.
JetBlue Flight 191 left New York bound for Las Vegas, but was diverted to Amarillo, Texas, when the captain flying the plane began behaving erratically in the cockpit. CBS News has learned that the captain's behavior alarmed the co-pilot to the point that locking the pilot out of the cockpit was the safest option.
He was knocking on the cockpit, trying to get in, screaming, let me in.
We found out that the guy banging was actually the pilot who was trying to get into the cockpit, because the other co-pilot had locked him out.
This is cell phone footage taken by a passenger from inside the plane just after the pilot was subdued.
Very quickly, maybe six or eight big New Yorkers just basically pinned him to the ground, and there was a guy literally pinning him to the ground until we made the emergency landing in Amarillo.
According to a government official, a retired NYPD officer also helped bring the pilot to the ground. Meanwhile, another JetBlue pilot was on board as a traveler and was ushered into the cockpit to assist in landing the plane.
Time is of the essence. You have to isolate them, you have to contain them, you have to restrain them. And that's kind of established protocol.
JetBlue officials issued this statement today declaring the plane was diverted because of a, quote, medical situation involving the captain.
The passengers on board Flight 191 are still in Amarillo at this hour and are waiting on a replacement plane to finally get them to their destination of Las Vegas. The pilot, as well as the entire flight crew, is now being interviewed by the FBI. Christine?
Flight to remember, Chris. Thank you. Now to...
Wow, very scary situation there. And of all people, you would not want the pilot in command to be the one to go nutso on you. So prayers to him and his family and all involved in that situation in Amarillo. And now you may be wondering what happened on the other side of the cockpit door. And I have some air traffic control tapes courtesy of ATC or liveatc.net. And let's listen to a little bit of that. It's kind of interesting to hear what was happening on the other side of the cockpit door.
Blue 191, Amarillo approach, 10 pilots discretion, maintain 6,000, and expect a visual approach runway 22. Do you guys have a an instrument approach set up that you want to shoot?
We're looking for it now, JetBlue 191.
JetBlue 191, roger for now. Just turn 5 degrees to the left, and if you need something different, let me know.
5 left, JetBlue 191.
Okay, now you know that, well, you don't know, but the airplane was en route from Kennedy to Las Vegas, Nevada. And when the captain left the cockpit, presumably to use the restroom, and that's when he started going berserk and yelling all kinds of strange things, having a panic attack, pounding on the cockpit door, etc. They were at 34,000 feet, 55 miles north, northwest, I think, of Amarillo. And the co-pilot made the proper decision, fearing that the captain was not, you know, in his right mind, and kept him outside of the cockpit and had the folks on the other side of the cockpit door subdue him. And so quickly, you know, what do you do in this situation? Well, you know you're not going to make it all the way to Vegas with somebody that's acting as unstable as this captain is. And so you think, okay, you look at your moving map display and you see that you're pretty close to Amarillo. You tell Fort Worth Center that you're declaring an emergency and you want to divert into Amarillo. And so this is where this ATC tape is picking up when they were down a little bit lower. I think they're around 12,000 feet, something like that, 8,000 feet. They're talking to Amarillo Approach Control. So let's continue with the... Oh, and he's scrambling, you know, trying to find the approach plates, the approach procedures for the airport in Amarillo.
Up emergency squad.
Affirmative.
191 radar. And if you could just go to 3340.
3340, JetBlue 191.
Radar. And JetBlue 191, maintain 8,000 for now. Traffic 12 o'clock and 7 miles. Altitude indicates 7,500 unverified.
Okay, 948, leveling off at 8,000, JetBlue 191.
Ground, Airport 5.
Airport 5, Emerald Ground.
Yes, sir. Do you know what type of aircraft is coming in and whether or not they've coordinated ground handling?
I told them I'd give them a call inbound. They got the vehicles moving over in the ramp.
Okay. I think their point of intention, they'd like to go to TAC Air Ramp.
Roger. Final approach, fix 6 feet if you have it plugged in. If not, fly heading 130, traffic no factor.
Okay, we'll do a heading 130, JetBlue 191.
Discretion to maintain 6,000.
Fly discretion 6,000, JetBlue 191. Do you have the minimums for that approach?
JetBlue 191, affirmative. Weather's will be plenty for the minimums, RNF. Do you want to go via June V or Zuka?
Can you give me a more specific nature of this medical emergency so I can pass it on to the ambulance crew?
Red 1, standby. Descent altitude is 4020, and you said Zuka?
Yes, that's affirmative. Thank you.
Clear to RNAV, Yankee runway 22, approach.
Okay, direct Zuka, maintain 6,000, clear to RNAV, Yankee 22, JetBlue 191, emergency.
Parking over here on the TAC Air ramp, is that correct?
Red 1, affirm, that's the plan for now. If anything changes, I'll let you know.
Red 1's clear.
JetBlue 191, maneuvering airspace is approved north of Zuka if you do need it for the turn.
1,000.
Copy, thanks.
Red 1 understands, 10 miles out.
JetBlue 191, and if I didn't give you the information, altimeter is 2997, the winds are 23010.
2997, JetBlue 191.
JetBlue 191, clear visual approach, runway 22.
Clear visual 22, JetBlue 191.
JetBlue 191, they do have people, personnel at the gate for you. Contact tower 118.3.
1183, JetBlue 191, 691, emergency 5400 for the visual 22. It's 8 miles out for the visual 22 emergency aircraft.
Okay, now he's been switched to tower at Amarillo.
JetBlue 191, I'm on tower runway 22, clear land, wind 230 at 10.
Clear land, JetBlue 191, emergency, and we're going to need authorities and medical to meet us at the airplane.
Yes, sir, they're standing by for you.
Airport 5, roger, inside, thank you.
JetBlue 191, clear land, runway 22.
Thanks, sir.
Can you have the airport police standby?
You want them to enter from Bravo or Juliet?
Bravo will be fine.
Roger. Left there on Papa and a right on Bravo.
Left Papa, right Bravo, going to ground point 9 at JetBlue 191.
Hey, Alpha.
Airport 5, exit Alpha.
Exit Alpha, Airport 5.
Roger. JetBlue 191, they have the air stairs ready as soon as you parked.
Cleveland request?
Right away if I could.
Squared 1, the pilot request medical and security as soon as able.
You got medical and security standing by. What orders do you want? L1 be sufficient?
JetBlue 191, do you have a door you prefer? Blue 191, you can contact the emergency personnel at 121.65. You guys can communicate that way. Red 1, you can communicate with JetBlue directly, 121.65.
Yeah, JetBlue 191, we're on 2165.
Amber, command, go JetBlue.
Yeah, you guys come up here to the right, right 1, that's fine.
They're putting the air stairs up to door R1 as we speak. If you can have somebody open it from the inside, we'll get it in position. We have medical and security personnel on the ground standing by the board.
Thanks, will do. Thank you.
Okay, that was all I could get from liveatc.net. And you could almost hear the disappointment or the, I don't know how to describe the first officer's voice there, but you could just tell that he was kind of sad that this had happened. You know, a somebody that he has probably flown with a time or two or many times, perhaps even a friend. And when somebody kind of, you know, has a psychological episode, it is disturbing. So anyway, again, our thoughts and prayers are with the captain and his family and the co-pilot and all the passengers and crew involved in getting JetBlue 191 safely on the ground. The latest report I've heard that they were flying in another airplane to take the passengers on to Las Vegas, and I hope by now it's about 8 o'clock in the evening here in Dallas. I hope by now that they have arrived safe and sound in Las Vegas, Nevada. So anyway, thought that would be interesting to look at. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this case in the coming days. So now, with something a little bit more upbeat, let me see, let me play.
You have new mail waiting.
Good. And actually, it wasn't mail. It was a text message. A friend of mine, a fellow host of a podcast, part of the StarQuest Production Network, Miss Pat Gone, sent a text message, or excuse me, a tweet to me, and she said, "How about, just for fun, a show that explains this song?" And then she sent me a link. And so I clicked on the link, and it played this song. So let's have a listen and see what we can figure out about this song.
If you feel that it's real, I'm on trial, and I'm here again, your prison.
Used without permission.
Like a coin in your mint, I am tempted, and I'm spent with hot treason.
I consider it fair use.
Through a glass eye, your throne is the one danger zone.
It's kind of like news.
Take me to the pilot for control. Take me to the pilot of your soul. Take me to the pilot, beam me to the tamer. Take me to the pilot, I'm but a stranger. Take me to the pilot, beam me to the tamer. Take me to the pilot, I'm but a stranger. Na na na, na na na, na na na, na 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 na.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. Pat wants to know exactly what this song means. And so let's look at the lyrics here. Here, let me turn Sir Elton down a little bit more here. There we go. So you can hear me talking. Okay. Oh, there we go. I didn't mean to turn him completely off. There we go. So here we go. If you feel that it's real, I'm on trial, and I'm here in your prison, like a coin in your mint. I'm dented, and I'm spent with high treason. Through a glass eye, Your throne is the one danger zone. Take me to the pilot for control. Take me to the pilot of your soul. Take me to the pilot. Lead me through the chamber. Take me to the pilot. I am but a stranger. Take me to the pilot. Lead me through the chamber. Take me to the pilot. I am but a stranger. Oh, I just repeated that verse. Well, I know he's not old, and I'm told he's a virgin, for he may be a she. But what I'm told is never for certain. So, hey, you know, I don't know what the confusion is, Pat. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. No, I'm just kidding. Wikipedia says, Take Me to the Pilot is a rock song performed by British musician Elton John. The song was written by Bernie Taupin and composed by Elton for his second album in 1970. It was released in 70 as the second single from the album, backed by, on the B-side, Your Song. Of course, both have received airplay, but of course, Your Song was the one that was preferred by disc jockeys and replaced Take Me to the Pilot as the A-side, eventually making both the UK and US top tens. So, let's read a little bit about the composition and inspiration. Many found this song's lyrics cryptic and incomprehensible. If you feel that it's real, I'm on trial, I'm here in your prison like a coin in your mint, I'm dented and spent with high treason, reads the first verse. The speaker in this odd tale then observes, through a glass eye, your throne is the one danger zone, and exhorts his captor to take me to the pilot for control, take me to the pilot of your soul. Bernie has said that he has no idea what the lyrics mean, comparing his writing style to the song to poets like Baudelaire and Rimbaud, who, I hope I pronounced that right, who just threw things together and went, wow, that sounds good. The lyrics possess many elements, betrayal, either political or personal, treason, the illusion of danger through a glass eye, and fearlessness toward the unknown. Take me to the pilot of your soul. According to Elton, this and other songs recorded during this period were inspired by the science fiction books Bernie was reading at the time. Anyway, so, yeah, you know what is interesting? I grew up listening to Elton John, and I don't recall this song. When I played it, when I clicked the link, Pat, I thought, wow, this is a great song. I love it. I've never heard it. That's kind of weird because, I mean, the 70s, that's when I grew up. 1970, I was, what, 11 years old? 10 years old, something like that? No. Yeah, I was like 11 years old, I think. And anyway, so thank you for pointing out this song to me. It's become one of my favorites, and it has caused me to go back and listen to a bunch of the Elton John stuff. Now, regardless of what you think about Elton's lifestyle and his political viewpoints, you have to admit he is quite a talented musician. And I was looking at some of the YouTube videos of some of his live shows where he's playing this song, and there's a great lead-in, or I don't know what you call the part of the song that goes on and on and on before the actual song starts. And anyway, awesome stuff. He's an amazing musician, amazing piano player. And speaking of amazing people, Pat Gohn, listen to her show, Among Women, on the StarQuest Production Network, sqpn.com. Okay, a Long Island couple wants the investigation of a lavatory leak from an overhead plane. This is in Malvern, New York. One Malvern couple was enjoying the mild night Thursday when they became covered by sludge as a plane taking off from Kennedy Airport flew overhead. And I don't think it was me. A plane was coming over. Next thing you know, she says, "Oh my gosh, it's raining." I said, "No, it's not." Artie Hughes told 1010 WINS Sonia Rincon. Some black liquid, black oil came off of her face, and I walked around and I looked and said, "Oh my God!" There was a quarter-sized, nickel-sized, dime-sized drops all over my deck, my barbecue, my table. He said, "I think something was wrong with the plane." They called police. It was an oily substance, blackish, greenish oil. I thought it was hydraulic fluid, and then the policeman came down and said, "No, I don't think so. Looks like something nastier than that." The officer suspected it was most likely treated sewage, returning after making several phone calls for confirmation. He had spoken to somebody down at either the Port Authority or the FAA and said, "Yeah, looks like there was an incident." He said some lavatory excrement had leaked out. Yuck. Isn't that nice, huh? All right. You remember me telling you or talking about the company Light Squared that was trying to get this new broadband system up using satellite and terrestrial antennas on Earth to bring broadband access to the places where it is not reaching at this point. And the troubles they were having with the interference with the GPS spectrum and the federal government, the DOT and the Department of Defense, among others, had said, wait, time out. This is going to be a problem with our sensitive navigation equipment and airplanes and other life-saving equipment. And notice this. Let's see, when was this dated? The end of February. LightSquared announced on Tuesday that Sanjeev Ahuja has resigned his position as chief executive officer at the company, but he will continue to serve as chairman of the board. So it looks like things are starting to fall apart there at LightSquared, and I'm sure that the investors are probably getting a little uneasy about what's going to happen with the money that they have invested so far in this company and this new satellite and terrestrial technology. So I'll keep you up to date with that, but that is the latest. The CEO has resigned. And for some reason, my sound playing application is having some hiccups in it for some reason. I don't know. Oh, well, let's see. Here's something I thought was interesting. I found this from Flight International. David Kaminsky Morrow in London. Spanish investigators have found that an overbearing captain helped create the circumstances for an unstable approach, which led an Air Europa Boeing 737-800 to overrun at Lanzarote. I'm probably mispronouncing that. Maybe it's Lanzarote. The aircraft overflew the runway 21 threshold at 55 meters, which is 180 feet, at 175 knots. With the flaps deployed at just 25 degrees owing to automated flap loading limitations. The airplane traveled halfway along the runway, which was wet, before touching down some 1,300 meters beyond the threshold. While the brakes were applied immediately, thrust reversers were not activated for 13 seconds, by which time the 737 was barely 200 meters from the end of the runway. The aircraft, which had arrived from Glasgow, overran at 94 meters and crossed a 60-meter stopway before coming to a halt just a meter, from the jet blast barrier next to the perimeter fence. Spanish investigation agency CIAIAC discovered that the 737 was originally to land on runway 3, and the first officer flying had programmed this descent into the flight management computer. But the captain opted instead for a runway 21 approach, the opposite direction, without consulting the first officer, forcing him to prepare a different landing procedure without much time. The aircraft at the time was at 14,600 feet and about 30 nautical miles from the runway. While the first officer tried with difficulty to reprogram the flight computer, the captain prompted him to keep descending. The first officer's lack of assertiveness to tell the captain that he did not agree with what he was being forced to do is undoubtedly a contributing factor to the genesis of this incident, said the Spanish agency CIAIAC. It said the captain made every decision, but at no time asked the first officer's opinion. Despite being aware of the worsening situation and undoubtedly noticing the inability of the first officer to cope with the runway change, The captain did not touch the controls or the autopilot. During the approach, the first officer was at times overwhelmed by work, while the captain limited himself to telling the first officer that he had to descend more without actually intervening directly. This happened, by the way, in October of 2008. While the captain had 8,388 hours on type, more than 10 times that of the first officer, they said that he decided to continue the approach in spite of the presence of a multitude of indications that suggested or required that the maneuver be stopped. These indications included the aircraft's high energy state as well as repeated alerts from the Enhanced Ground Proximity Warning System over a 28-second period as it descended below 900 feet. Although the aircraft sustained minor tire damage in the incident, none of the 80 occupants was injured. Okay, so this was, I think a lot of people would say, a near disaster. Had it gone even a little bit further, or there wasn't such a long stopway on this runway, it is very possible and likely that this would have involved at least several, serious injuries, if not fatalities. And so let's go back here and see what happened. The setup. We're planning for one thing, and then for some reason, in this case the captain, deciding that, nope, we're not going to go to runway 3, we're going to do runway 21. We're coming in from this direction, and this is going to be more expeditious. And so immediately from at that point, the aircraft is at a very high energy state. Normally at 30 miles from the airport, going in that same direction, you'd probably be, you want to be about 10,000 feet above the ground. Now, I don't know what the field elevation is at this particular airport, so I'm assuming that it's close to sea level. And in this case, they're at nearly 15,000 feet, so they're, about 5,000 feet higher than they should be for a normal, stabilized 3-to-1 kind of descent to the runway. So, what do you have to do in this case? Well, you have to, if you're flying the airplane, you have to decide, okay, I recognize I'm in a high energy state, and I need to get drag going here. So I need to put the speed brakes out, I need to slow down, maybe put the slats out, maybe put some flaps out as well, and do everything I can, even perhaps requesting some maneuvering space to lose the altitude. It seems to me, now I have not looked at the report myself, I'm just looking at this article from Flight International, but I'm assuming that the first officer didn't request any of that stuff. And let me talk a little bit about something that happens, and it's happened to me on several occasions when I was a young, inexperienced co-pilot, and you're flying with a very senior and experienced captain. You sometimes experience something called co-pilot-itis, I think I've heard people refer to it as, where you kind of are afraid to say anything. You're flying with somebody who should know everything there is to know about flying the airplane, and you kind of succumb to this feeling that you don't want to say anything because maybe he's right and it's going to work out. But you have to get over that, and most of us do after we have a little bit more experience under our belt. And we pipe up and say, you know what, I don't want to do this. I've already, configured the flight data computer or the flight computer to do the approach to the other runway, and our energy state is too high. But, of course, he didn't do any of that. And one of the things that I caught in this article that kind of bothered me, and I guess is still an example of a symptom that I see, this automation dependency that we have, or that I see creeping into a lot of operations, and that is he was busy trying to reprogram the flight management system. Okay, newer generation pilots, I'm finding, are doing that. They get kind of focused in on, doing everything they want the airplane to do through this computer instead of recognizing the situation immediately. Oh, my energy state is too high. I need to get this airplane down. Okay, go into a more manual control mode of the autopilot, not letting the flight management system, not taking the time to reprogram the flight management computer. Just, go into vertical speed or indicated airspeed and pull the power back. Even disconnect the autopilot system completely. Just put your hands on the yoke and your hands on the throttles. Click everything off and fly the darn airplane and get it down. And seems to me it's it seems to indicate to me, reading between the lines, that a lot of time was taken by the first officer trying to reprogram the flight management computer. And regardless of what caused this thing, by when it reached a point when they were much lower to the ground and much closer to the runway, and they were still at a very, very high speed, and they were getting the enhanced ground proximity warning system for over a 28-second period, basically saying probably, you know, descent rate, or, you know, I don't know what the warning system was saying at that point, but I'm sure that they had a very high descent rate, and who knows what else it was trying to warn them of. But that would have been the point where you say, you know what, this is unsafe, we're going around. But they didn't. They continued, tried to salvage a bad approach, and it led to a near disaster. So, moral to the story there, you know, if you're a co-pilot and you're doing something that you're uncomfortable with, you know, say something about it, and don't spend so much time fiddling with that darn flight management system or that flight management computer. Fly the airplane. And then if it's in a, you're still in an unsafe situation, go around and try it again. And if it makes your captain mad at you, well, then you can tell him, well, we can go together and talk to the chief pilot about this and see what he has to say about it. Okay. Let's look at this. Let's see, how are we doing on time here? Oh, about a half an hour. That's not bad. Here's another article that I happened to see in the past few weeks. Loss of control risk behind proposed 737 wiring changed, by John Croft in Washington, D.C. for Flight Global. And this is dated 27 February 2012. Three reports of pilots failing to manually activate air data sensor heating systems on next-generation Boeing 737 aircraft have prompted the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration to propose a fix to more than 1,000 aircraft in the U.S. registered fleet. Air data sensors include pitot tubes, which, if partially or fully blocked by ice, provide erroneous airspeed information to the flight deck. The affected airplanes do not have an automatic activation of the air data sensor heating system, said the FAA. Pilots activate the system manually as a pre-flight checklist item. Failure to activate the air data sensor heating system could result in ice formation on air data system sensors, which could lead to misleading airspeed data or loss of all airspeed indicating systems and loss of control of the airplane. Okay, my question here is, now, I've not flown the 737-800, but I've flown the Boeing 727, well, and I'm not including all the military airplanes I flew, but the L-1011, the 727, the MD-88, MD-90 series airplanes, and all the airplanes I flew in the military, none of them, zero, had an automatic activation of the air data sensor heating system. We call it the pitot heat switch. You turn it on. That's part of our pre-flight. And that's one of the things you check for before you take off, just to make sure that your pitot-static system is heated. And I don't know why the 737 is any different from any other airplane out there and why they have to go through this airworthiness directive to get this thing wired so that it happens automatically. Come on. It's just something, it's called checklist discipline. You make sure that this is on. Now, the reason why I always look at that pitot heat switch, ever since I read about that 727 that crashed, I think it was a charter flight. I think it was out of Buffalo, New York. This was in the 70s, I believe. It was a charter flight carrying, I don't know, all the details are kind of hazy in my mind, but I think it was some kind of a college, or may have been a professional sports team. They forgot to turn on the pitot heat. They flew into icing conditions. It stopped up the pitot tube, and they lost their pitot-static instruments. And instead of setting proper pitch attitude and throttle settings and just flying the airplane through the icing situation, they lost control of the airplane, and they crashed. So every time I take the runway, I look up at the overhead panel and make sure that pitot heat switch is in the on position. So I just thought it was odd. Now, those of you out there who fly the 737 series or other Boeing airplanes, let me know. Do you have automated systems that come on for air data sensors? Maybe I'm out to lunch here, but I just thought that was strange. Why they are so concerned about the 737. Okay, moving on. Airbus 320 near Basel, Switzerland, on February 29th, foreign object noise on board identified as BlackBerry. An Air France Airbus performing flight Air France 2220 from Paris Charles de Gaulle to Tel Aviv with 124 passengers and 6 crew was en route to or at flight level 280, about 5 nautical miles north of Basel, Switzerland. When upon checking in with Swiss radar, the crew reported they had a foreign object on board and were considering a divert. 4 minutes later, the crew declared, "Mayday, mayday, mayday," reporting they had some foreign noise on board and decided to divert to the Basel Mulhouse Airport, where the aircraft landed safely about 20 minutes later. A replacement Airbus 320 was positioned to the airport and reached Tel Aviv with a delay of 18 hours. Passengers reported a bleeping sound was heard in about the fifth seat row in the cabin, and the cabin crew was called and tried to determine the source of the bleeping, however, could not find anything. The sound was considered to originate from a bomb. The captain was informed and decided to divert. The aircraft stopped in a remote area of Mulhouse's airport. Passengers disembarked, and the aircraft was searched. Following the search, the passengers were told that this keeps referring to it as a bleeping sound. I think it's probably a beeping sound. Was the reminder call of a BlackBerry which hadn't been turned off. So, yet another reason to turn off those darn electronic devices. But now, I don't know about you. Now, I'm not a bomb expert, but I think that we've been watching too many of these things on TV where they have a bomb and the thing is beeping, like an audible sound. I don't think a real bomb makes an audible beeping sound. Okay, any of you out there, do you know? I don't think so. But anyway, I guess they were concerned and they wanted to err on the side of safety and they decided to divert. So, again, make sure those electronic devices are off. Now, speaking of electronic devices, let me jump over here to this one. And this was sent to me, some feedback from my friend and frequent feedbacker, Pratik Gorodia. And this is from the New York Times. And the name of the article is "Disruptions, Time to Review FAA Policy on Gadgets." Let's see. On Monday morning, I'm going to drive to the airport, check in for my flight to New York, and then head to the airport bookstore for a stack of magazines to read on the plane. I'll do this reluctantly because I will carry both an Amazon Kindle and an Apple iPad packed full of reading material in my bag. I need the paper products because the FAA rules state that I cannot use these digital reading devices on an airplane during taxi, takeoff, or landing. But this rule might change soon. When I called the FAA, and this is all written by Nick Bilton from the New York Times. When I called the FAA last week to pester them about this regulation, citing experts and research that says these devices could not harm a plane, the FAA responded differently than it usually does. Laura J. Brown, Deputy Assistant Administrator for Public Affairs for the FAA, said that the agency has decided to take a, quote, fresh look at the use of personal electronics on planes. That's going to be welcome news to the people in the United States who, according to Forrester Research, by the end of 2012, will have bought more than 40 million e-readers and 60 million iPads and other tablets. Yes, you read that correctly. The FAA, which in the past has essentially said no because I said so, is going to explore testing e-readers, tablets, and certain other gadgets on planes. The last time this testing was done was 2006, long before iPads and most e-readers even existed. Let's see. The bad or good news is that the FAA doesn't yet want to include the 150 million smartphones in this revision. And I think that's because we don't want to be listening to people yakking on the phone on the airplane. Ms. Brown said, that the administration's current rules allow airlines to request use of electronic devices once the airline demonstrated the devices would not interfere with aircraft avionics. Airlines have not done this because it's expensive and a laborious affair. So, likely bowing to public pressure, the FAA has decided to take this initiative into its own hands and it's going to figure out a way to start testing new electronics on airplanes. So anyway, I'll give you the rest of the gist of this article. They said it's going to take some time because apparently they need to test each and every one of these different devices to make sure that they're all going to be safe. So don't expect to see this change come anytime soon. But as I predicted, you know my stance on electronic devices. My personal opinion is that they have no effect. And I've said that all along, and even though people have sent me nasty emails and have argued with me over and over and called me an idiot for saying so, I have continued to say, and I will continue to say, that we will be using electronic devices on airplanes in the not-so-distant future. Because guess what, guys and gals? They don't affect anything on the airplane. Okay. Let's see. Let's jump to this one. Some more email feedback. This from Alexander Woltz. Hi, Captain Jeff. First off, let me thank you for providing such a high-quality, fun-to-listen-to podcast. Hey, thanks. I bumped into Catholic Pilot back in November 2011 and have been working diligently to catch up from Episode 1. It took me a while, but I am now caught up. Bless your heart, Alexander. As a longtime aviation fan, frequent flyer of ACME, and current Boston resident, I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast. For being an aviation guy, I find it funny that I still suffer from anxiety from flying. Although it's starting to subside, your podcast always helps ease my nerves. Well, thanks. I'm glad that I'm helping, Alexander. Let's see. He writes a personal note here, so I won't talk about that. Let's see. On an airline pilot guy note, you have talked quite a bit about automation over the past 10 episodes. I saw this article and thought it would be a great fit for your show. He has a link there to this article. Technology may be eroding pilot skills. And he ends his email, if you're ever in the Boston area, which I know you frequent, please let me know as I would be happy to buy you lunch, dinner. I live over in Cambridge, and since I know you like good food, I can recommend a couple of hidden gems within Boston. That would be awesome, Alexander. I'll take you up on that. And you don't have to buy me lunch. We can go Dutch treat. Anyway, the article from the Chicago Tribune, March 19th, 2012, so not that long ago. As I said, technology may be eroding pilot skills. Training should refocus on manual flying expertise to avoid automation dependency, experts say. Automation in the cockpit of commercial airliners has flown full circle over the past half century, leading experts to raise concerns about the erosion of manual piloting skills. The impact of automation dependency, creating a potentially dangerous scenario in which pilots are the backup to the automation, has escaped the attention of most airline passengers as well as many members of Congress responsible for overseeing airline safety, some experts say. And as an aside, I agree with them. There's no dispute that automated systems on the flight deck of planes have saved countless lives over the years by acting as the helpful equivalent of a third pilot in the cockpit. In addition, autopilot controls can fly planes more efficiently than human pilots, leading to savings on fuel burn and better adherence to staying on fly-quiet tracks near residential areas around airports, according to experts. But as the technology has advanced, automation has made it easy for pilots to become over-dependent on the autopilot system, yes, which is not infallible in terms of the risk of providing false information to the pilots. While some foreign airlines have revised their policies on the use of automation and strengthened their manual flying instruction, pilots training at U.S. carriers have not kept up with changes in automation. I agree. The U.S. Senate Aviation Subcommittee will hold a hearing on Tuesday to examine how much progress has been made by the FAA and the airline industry in meeting tougher safety requirements mandated by 2010 legislation. The new rules, which require higher standards for pilot training and dramatically raise the number of minimum flight hours for pilots applying for airline jobs, were established in the wake of the February 2009 crash of Colgan Air Flight 3407 in Buffalo. The mistakes that the Colgan captain committed in response to a low-speed warning system designed to prevent the commuter jet from stalling exposed a fatal disconnect between what the pilot expected the plane to do and what he actually experienced. Concerns run deep that the airline industry that during flight situations that could quickly escalate into emergencies, pilots might rely too heavily on interacting with computerized flight systems instead of looking out the windshield to point the nose in the right direction, listening to the hum of the engines and flying the plane. Yes, automation can dull the discovery of a problem if a crew relies on it too much, said Tom Peterson, manager of the Advanced Simulation Program at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. Our instructors teach our students that if some problem develops suddenly, don't automatically try to reprogram the system. Remember the story I just told you about that Spanish flight overrunning the runway? That's what happened. Well, that's one of the things that happened in that particular incident. Okay, going back to this article. Just go back to the day when you were 16 years old and flying a small Cessna. Hand fly the plane and look out the window, Peterson said. A knee-jerk decision to troubleshoot automated readings appears to have contributed to the fatal crash of Air France Flight 447, an Airbus 330 en route to Paris from Rio de Janeiro, that went into a high-altitude loss of airspeed and plunged into the Atlantic Ocean, killing all 228 people on board. The pilots lost control in part because they responded incorrectly to an airspeed indicator failure and misinterpreted the problems that were occurring. It goes on. You get the gist of the article here. People are starting to listen. I mean, there have been a lot of safety experts over the years saying, hey, you know, these automation systems are great. I mean, airline management loves them. The line check airmen, pilot managers at airlines love these things. You know why? Because they fly very precise paths. They supposedly save fuel. But guess what? We're becoming overly dependent on them. And we have to use our flying skills to watch what the automation is doing. And if we don't like it, then we do something about it, even if it means disconnecting the whole darn thing and flying the darn airplane. Man, I can't say it enough. And as you guys know, I'm very concerned about this, and I see it getting worse. I mean, the new generation pilots I fly with, they're all into the automation to the extent that if something happens, they have their heads down just punching away, just typing away with these things. And I'm looking out the window going, what are you looking at? There's the runway. You know, you don't need to have your head down between your legs, you know, programming a flight computer. Just fly the darn airplane. You know, where are you people? You know, don't you want to fly airplanes? Or do you want to type? Okay. Let's see. This from Dan. I don't know what your last name is, Dan. I'm sorry. Hello, Captain Jeff. Just discovered your podcast not long ago and finished listening to all of the episodes. Love the show, and no need to worry about going too long on the podcast. Good thing. Let's see, we're almost at 50 minutes now. The longer the show, the better. Well, thanks, Dan. I'll keep going then. One episode in particular caught my attention. A flight instructor from my province of Manitoba, Canada, had written a couple articles that he shared with you. May look him up when I start my flight training later this year. This particular email is in regard to the discussion you brought up in one of the latest episodes concerning the use of drones in the national airspace. Just noticed the article, and he gave me a link to it today that pertains to this. I know your feelings on the use of drones amongst aircraft with human pilots, and I agree 100%. Drones have their use in military applications, of course, but as with automation in aircraft, we shouldn't be taking the human out of the equation. My question is, how do you think this questionnaire of sorts will be received, as they are reportedly asking pilots what they think? Will they get the picture when the vast majority of pilots tell them that they do not want this test bed in their backyard? Your thoughts are greatly appreciated, and keep up the great work. Regards, Dan. Well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate your feedback. Keep listening, and thanks for listening to them all. I don't even know if I could do that now. I probably couldn't listen to myself yak. But, yeah, keep listening and keep contributing to it, because as I haven't said it yet on this podcast, but you all know how I feel about you, my listeners. We're all in this together, and heck, if it weren't for you sending me feedback, I'd probably have nothing to talk about, so I do appreciate it. And the link to the article is here, FAA seeking comment on UAS, and then in parentheses, drone test sites. The FAA plans to identify six test ranges to integrate unmanned aircraft systems, oh, that's what UAS stands for, into the National Airspace System, and is seeking pilot input. And I plan on filling out the survey myself and giving them my input. The FAA says it will host webinars for further exchange of information between the agency and the public. The sites will be used to help develop certification standards and the traffic requirements for unmanned flight operations applicable to both civil and public unmanned systems. Comments will be accepted for the next 60 days. And this is dated the 8th of March, so hey, I have time. Drones currently need to acquire special permission from the FAA to fly in the U.S., and remotely piloted aircraft aren't yet allowed to fly in national airspace. By 2015, the FAA hopes to have drones fully integrated into the national airspace. Yay! No. Information learned from operating the vehicles and the test sites will help develop strategies to meet safety standards before the aircraft become more common. The move is motivated by language in the FAA reauthorization bill. Comments are meant to acquire information regarding a range of topics beyond geographic considerations. Okay, so that is very interesting. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's possible that unmanned vehicles may be able to coexist as long as they have the same kind of, you know, beacon systems that other airplanes that have pilots behind the controls have, so that we can see where they are and be forewarned about their positions, and having some kind of a fail-safe system in case the reporting equipment on their airplanes malfunctions. And I don't know. I think that, you know, this is, I think, well, I don't know if it's good, but at least they're testing these things in test ranges and seeing how the flying public feels about the existence of these things. But as you know, Dan, and many of the rest of you know, I don't think they belong in our airspace system. But you know me, I'm just an old fogey, curmudgeon. Oh, let's see. Received this feedback from Super Dave, the guy that did that great graphic of the Flight Aware track that spelled out ACME, my airline. And let's see, just finished Airline Pilot Guide 24. Glad you're back. Thanks. Regarding the 7-3 running off the end of the runway at Atlanta, I'm glad to hear more background on it. It makes a whole lot more sense now with this information. It brings to mind my days on the third shift maintenance working for commuter airlines. Back then, we always had several things that were considered essential doing a nighttime maintenance power run. Number one, always leave enough room ahead of you in case the aircraft were to get away from you, jump chocks, or lose brakes. Two, always keep landing/taxi lights on so you can see the ground in case you start creeping. Three, never go on a power run between midnight and sunrise alone. No matter how awake you are, the engine noise, gyro hum, airframe rocking will rock you to sleep. 4. Somebody always is looking outside. Never have everyone's head in the panel. That's good advice, whether you're doing an engine run or you're taxiing the airplane or flying the airplane. somebody should always have their head, their eyeballs outside, looking outside. And number five, finally, never, ever, ever, ever run or start up pointing toward the hangar or a large group of aircraft. I knew some guys who used to work for Air Wisconsin in the winter, and they actually had to do chained down power runs when there was ice and snow. I bet it would beat you to death doing it, since the struts wouldn't absorb a lot of vibration. Yeah, I bet that would be rough, Dan. Keep up the good work, David. Excuse me, David. I don't know why I call you Dan. David from Loganville, Georgia. And he said, P.S., I'll be following this email with one containing some pictures. He got them on airliners.net several years ago, and they are the pictures. They're the result of a maintenance run that ended up in the hangar at an American Eagle facility. They were pulled off the airliner's net within days, but I saved a copy of them before that. With that in mind, I don't own the rights to them for sharing. Just thought you would find them interesting and a little shocking too. And yeah, I looked at those pictures, and quite a bit of damage done to an engine run that either was done in the hangar or nearby, and the airplane ended up in the hangar and commingling with some other airplanes. A little bit of damage there. So thanks for your feedback, David. You didn't tell me I couldn't read it, so ha, I read it. I appreciate all the feedback you give me. And keep it up. Hi, Captain Jeff. This is from John Clem. There was a cool video of a man who had built a Da Vinci-like human wings and demonstrated flight on a video that went viral. Father Roderick, he's the CEO of SQPN, wrote me back saying that the man has come forward to say it was a hoax. Too bad, as it looks real, but it could be a good discussion for your podcast. And he has a link to the YouTube video of this guy, this Flying Dutchman. He's speaking in Dutch, and they have some subtitles to see what he's saying. And yeah, it does look real, but apparently it was all a hoax. And he's running along and flapping his arms, and these big wings are flapping like a bird and flying. And it's got a helmet cam on and everything else. But nope, we're not there yet. I think that you'd have to have a lot of strength in your arms to flap those big giant wings enough to help you actually fly. But it was interesting nonetheless. So thanks, John, for the feedback. Let's see. John also sent me a link to a website that has a whole bunch of great photos vapor trails, the contrails that come out the back of jets. You know, you see them up in the sky when the atmosphere is really moist and conditions are just right for these ice crystals to form from the vapor of the jet engines. And a lot of really cool images, and I'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes so you all can look at them as well. And if I can figure out if any of them are not copyrighted, I'll maybe include one as the image for this episode. Okay, moving on. More feedback. Carl Stebbings writes from England. Hello, Pilot Jeff. Greetings from the UK. Just thought I would drop you a line and congratulate you on making a great podcast. I'm not sure how many UK fans you have, but I'd like to count myself as one. Being a huge fan of all things with wings, I've loved flying all my life and have had flying lessons in a Cessna 150, but due to getting married last September, I haven't been up for a while. Here in the UK, I follow commercial aviation on a daily basis and have written small articles on the subject. Oh, cool. The aircraft love of my life is the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar, but sadly, there are not many still flying in the UK apart from the RAF 500 series models, which are being phased out in a couple of years. Well, keep up the great work, Jeff. Clear skies and tailwinds. Kind regards, Carl Stebbings. And then he puts a PS in there. Let me know if you ever need an English co-host of the show. Well, thanks. I'll keep you in mind, Carl. Now, I do have a good friend over there, and his name is Sean McCarney. He is also a podcaster, host of Just a Catholic Dad, a fantastic podcast you can find as on SQPN as well, sqpn.com. And again, his podcast, Just a Catholic Dad. He talks about all kinds of things. Among them is his job as an air traffic controller. He works the tower at Farnborough. And so I have a few listeners in the UK, and I appreciate you guys over the on the other side of the pond. And I'll definitely keep you in mind, Carl. And thanks for the feedback. All right, let's see. Here's some lengthy feedback from Sebastian. Hey, Captain Jeff. Started listening to your podcast about 5 months ago and have grown a big fan. Nevertheless, I would hereby like to give you some feedback on your last show. Uh-oh. last show, Airline Pilot Guy number 23. Now, I was planning on reading this on the last show, 24, but I didn't get to it, so here we go. CSA CPT incapacitation. Thanks for the audio feedback. Okay, that was the Czechoslovakian airplane where the captain was incapacitated and the first officer took over and landed safely. Okay, so going back to Sebastian's feedback. I am a FO with a European major and have been flying the 737, 300, 500, 700, 800 for more than 8 years now. I must say our Czech colleague has done one really good job, and I agree. You can tell he's quite nervous since requesting multiple readbacks, even after having flown for almost 10 years professionally myself. I must say I'm pretty sure I would be nervous myself. Not about handling the airplane all alone, but about the fact of having to deal with death. Imagine you have been on a rotation with a colleague for some days, and suddenly this very same colleague you have been flying with dies sitting right next to you. Yeah, I know. That must be pretty traumatic. Fuel savings. I agree 100% with your opinion on using the APU for the aircraft while taxiing in. Just one question. Is the aircraft on the... air conditioning on the MD-80 series really not strong enough to get enough air in the cabin during idle ground operations? No, it's not. even on the... Well, you know, I take that back. It's if we have both engines running, it is. And depending on the time of year, if it's not too hot outside, one engine operating with the air conditioning pack on is good. It keeps the airplane very comfortable. But when we get into the hotter late spring, summer months, especially in the southeastern United States, it gets awfully hot and humid. And one engine and sometimes even two have a tough time keeping the cabin comfortable. So the APU is almost a must that time of year. Okay, going back to his feedback. In fact, that is prohibited on the 737 due to possible back pressure to the APU. He says they never use the APU for air conditioning while taxiing in. Huh. But there's one thing I hate. Now, honestly, I don't necessarily use the APU taxiing in strictly to provide additional airflow for the air conditioning system. I have it there so that it's ready to take the air conditioning load once we shut down the engines at the gate and while we're awaiting the ground crew to connect the external air conditioning system to the airplane and keep it cool. So kind of between that transition between getting the hose connected and you know, the engine shut down, it's nice to have that air conditioning system running. And, you know, we all know how quickly a car gets hot, even when it's cold outside. I mean, well, like right now, let's say it's 45 degrees outside. It's a sunny day. You're in your car. All the windows are rolled up, and the sun is beating down. And guess what? It's going to get hot in your car. Even if it's 40 degrees outside, when you're inside of that, you know, greenhouse, it gets hot very, very quickly. And that's why it's important that we have the ground crews get the external air conditioning on the airplane as quickly as they can once we get to the gate and we shut down the engines. Okay, going back to his feedback. But there's one thing I hate. While with the outside air temperature being 70 or more and full cabin, the APU has to be switched on reaching the gate for passenger comfort. Having to deadhead quite a bit, I always give feedback to my colleagues leaving the airplane. Yeah, I know. When you're sitting in the back and you feel how hot it gets, you know, without any air on, it's very frustrating. Okay, fuel saving. Now do you say, Now you say, do you think that the captain would have made the same decision with the CEO on board? Funny you say so, because deadheading, I noticed the higher up a captain is in my company, meaning being an old training captain or management pilot, the worse the cabin air is. I think us normal pilots care more about the cabin air than those captains who are further up the ladder. That is as if they are personally profiting from the bucks they save. By the way, we do have the same guideline you refer to in our operations manual. We are supposed to care about safety first and passenger comfort second. Okay, yeah, so basically what Sebastian's saying here is it seems like the guys that are in the management pilot ranks and higher up seem to be more concerned about the bottom line, the money. And, you know, that kind of makes sense. They're involved with the financial aspect of the running the airline, and they start thinking more from that perspective than the more practical perspective of actually sitting there in a seat and burning up. And again, I think that's a false economy. I think, what's the phrase? Penny wise and pound foolish. I think that we need to keep, you know, the comfort level reasonable for our passengers, because, you know, they're paying a lot of money to fly these airplanes or fly on these airplanes to get from point A to point B. And I think we should make it as comfortable as we can without going crazy spending money that we don't have to. Okay, VNAV. I was quite surprised on your mentioning a VNAV approach being not that high a passenger comfort approach. I've talked to a lot of friends and have received the same feedback from all of them. On the 737, which I fly, as well as the A320 series, A330 and A340, as well as the A380 and Boeing 747-400, a VNAV descent has absolutely no influence on the cabin rate of descent. On all these types, the cabin controller is programmed to climb the cabin at 350 to 450 feet per minute and descend the cabin at 500 feet per minute. So, unless you, quote, overtake the cabin, there is absolutely no difference for the passengers. I have overtaken my cabin about 3 times, but all those situations were after a descent with 330 knots and speed breakout after the air traffic controller had cut the arrival quite a bit shorter following a change of runway. In all of those situations, I caught up with the cabin at roughly 1,500 feet, where I was on the ILS with an aircraft rate of descent being 500 to 600 feet per minute. That was not as comfortable as it could have been, but definitely not that bad. All CDA or VNAV approaches we have in Europe are designed for a standard idle descent, with the speed brake, of course, being stowed. Otherwise, the benefit of flying an idle descent would be destroyed right away. With the indicated airspeed being about 280 to 300 knots, even on the aerodynamically very dirty 737-500 through 300, the rate of descent rarely gets to be more than 3,500 feet per minute and becomes less the lower we get. So you never catch up with the cabin. The only noticeable change in cabin pressure is during a sudden level off following a descent, especially when the engines spool up to about 65% N1, and when the air conditioning pack controller changes from high pressure 9th stage bleed to a low pressure 5th stage bleed air demand. A true continuous idle VNAV descent from flight level down to glide slope capture is not only very economic, but also not noticeable for any of our passengers. Also, leveling off is not noticeable when the level off is flown in vertical speed and the rate of descent reduces gradually to 2,000 feet per minute at 2,000 feet prior to reaching the assigned level, and further down to 1,000 feet per minute at 1,000 above the cleared level, which is an ATC and TCAS requirement anyway. Thank you for the great show. Hope for much more to come. Also, keep the blue side up, Sebastian. Okay, now, yeah, I really wanted to talk about this, Sebastian. And, you know, sometimes I forget to mention that when I'm talking about VNAV descents, I'm talking specifically, in most cases, specifically about the airplane that I fly. And the McDonnell Douglas 80-90 series airplane was really not designed, the VNAV system really wasn't designed for the performance of the airplane, or at least it hasn't adapted very well to the flight characteristics of this airplane that I fly. And so I realized that a lot of airplanes that Boeing makes and Airbus makes are much, well, the integration of the VNAV flight management system is much better than on the airplane that I'm flying. Now, come on, let's face it, the MD-80-90 series airplane is really nothing more than a newer version of the DC-9, a longer DC-9 with more advanced or modern avionics. And so, you know, right off the bat, it doesn't do things as well as all the airplanes that you just mentioned here. So when I refer to the VNAV approach being uncomfortable on the airplane, it's the airplane that I fly. So I should make that point more clear. And thank you for pointing that out, Sebastian. This is the only airplane that I've flown with a VNAV system. The L-1011, the 727, and the Air Force, the C-141, and of course the trainers, obviously, didn't have flight management systems with vertical navigation. So this is my first experience with VNAV, and apparently this particular airplane doesn't do a very good job with it. And I can guarantee you that an idle descent from normal cruise altitudes on the airplane that I fly, going back to idle, immediately we're going to get a flow light, which indicates that the outflow valve trying to, you know, make the rate of descent a reasonable rate of descent as far as the cabin is concerned, you know, the ear popping thing, immediately the outflow valve is in a position where it's fully closed and it's still not able to keep up with the cabin, and things get uncomfortable very, very quickly. So you have to keep some power on just to maintain a comfortable ear popping rate. And I'm sure that a lot of airplanes out there have the systems are designed, the engines and the bleed systems to supply the air conditioning systems with enough air pressure to keep the cabin descending at a reasonable rate. I'm sure that those airplanes are designed to do that. My airplane? No, it's not. But we're still doing it, or at least they're trying to convince us to do it, and that's why I say, no, it's too uncomfortable. I'll start a nice, easy descent, and that somewhere along the line I'll end up intercepting the 3-to-1 line and doing an idle descent. But anyway, so thanks for pointing that out, Sebastian. And hey, if you're flying airplanes out there like the ones that Sebastian is talking about, you pilots out there flying for airlines, let me know how your airplane does with the idle descents. And it'd be good to hear some data points from the rest of you. All right. Well, you know what? Yeah, I've done it again. I'm way over an hour. So I'm going to go ahead and end the show. And again, thanks for all your feedback. And, you know, I'm almost caught up. I'm looking here and I see maybe, three or four that I intended to read on today's show, but I didn't quite make it. But they're good pieces of feedback, and it'll be worth the wait for our next show. So keep sending it in, folks. If you heard something you like or dislike with today's show, or you want me to answer a question about something else, send it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. That's feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Or you can send in some voice feedback. I love voice feedback. Haven't gotten much of it lately. And that's area code 304-997-4568. That's easier to remember if it just say 304-99-PILOT. And you can find all that information on my website, airlinepilotguy.com. You can find me on Facebook. Just do a search for Airline Pilot Guy or Captain Jeff. And on Twitter, I am Airline Pilot Guy, all one word. And until next time, I hope you have a great week. Keep the sunny side up, the blue skies, the clear skies, the tailwinds, and all that jazz. So take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.